Hi, this is Mrs. English, and today I'll be reading aloud from Homer's Odyssey, the Richmond Lattimore translation of Homer's Odyssey. With the Odyssey, we'll be hearing about the wanderings and the travels and the exciting adventures of our hero Odysseus from the Iliad. You know they were at Troy almost 10 years, battling Troy. And they finally conquer Troy, burn it up, and now the heroes try to get back home. These sets of stories are called the Nostoi, the homecomings of the Achaeans, of the Greeks. There are many of them. The Odyssey is the longest, and this is book one that we begin today. Book one. Homer begins by invoking the Muse. This is the job of the muse to provide him with memory and of the details, since Homer, the poet or the bard, was not actually there. Only she can tell the truth of the past events. And the muse, of course, who would be important for this one, would be Mnemosyne, the muse of memory, the daughter of Zeus and one of the daughters of Zeus. Tell me, muse, line one, of the man of many ways, who was driven far journeys after he had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Notice here, right away on line two, after he doesn't say after they or after the Achaeans had sacked Troy's sacred citadel. Homer says after he, Odysseus. This tells us that Odysseus is getting the credit for sacking Troy because the horse was his idea. Line three. Many were they whose cities he saw, whose minds he learned of, many the pains he suffered in his spirit on the wide sea, struggling for his own life and the homecoming of his companions. Even though he could not save his companions, hard though he strove to, they were destroyed by their own recklessness, fools, who devoured the oxen of Helios, the sun god. And you will hear this story later on. And he took away the day of their homecoming. From some point here, goddess, daughter of Zeus, speak and begin our story. Lines 1 to 10, therefore, are called the proem, and this is Homer invoking the muse. When you think of the Greek word homecoming, it's the word nostos, and it is the source, it's the root of our word nostalgia, a coming home. It's a good, it's a positive feeling, and that is the focus of this book. Line 11. Then all the others, as many as fled sheer destruction, were at home now, having escaped the sea and the fighting. This one alone, Odysseus, longing for his wife and his homecoming, was detained by the queenly nymph Calypso, bright among goddesses in her hallowed caverns, desiring that he should be her husband. Line 15 tells us that Calypso desires Odysseus to be her husband. Calypso is one of the daughters of the Titan Atlas, and you will discover later in book 7, line 259, that she keeps him on her island trapped for 7 years. When Homer says in line 11, all the others, we will hear about the returns of Nestor, of Menelaus, and Agamemnon. We'll hear what happens to them, and of the non-returns of Achilles and of Aias, just as important. Continuing with line 16. But when in the circling of the years, that very year came in which the gods had spun for him his time of homecoming to Ithaca, because Odysseus is the king of Ithaca, and not even then was he free of his trials, nor among his own people. So even though he got home, he's not free from trial. But all the gods pitied him, line 20, except Poseidon. Think of scary music, na 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 na. He remained relentlessly angry with godlike Odysseus until his return to his own country. When Odysseus gets to Ithaca, Poseidon gives up. Line 22. But Poseidon was gone now to visit the far Ethiopians, most distant of men, who lived divided, some at the setting of Hyperion, some at his rising. He received a hecatomb of bulls and rams. There he sat at the feast and took his pleasure. Meanwhile, the other Olympian gods were gathered together in the halls of Zeus. First among them to speak was the father of gods and mortals, for he was thinking in his heart of stately Aegisthus, whom Orestes, Agamemnon's far-famed son, had murdered. Here, lines 29 and 30, we have references to stories you are not familiar with yet. However, you remember when Agamemnon tried to leave from Aulis, there were no winds to sail, and it was prophesied he must give his daughter Iphigenia as a sacrifice to Artemis for fair winds. Long story behind that, we'll get to that later. And he does so. He's gone almost 10 years. You can imagine the home warming when Agamemnon comes home from Troy, back to his wife Clytemnestra. And of course, the long and the short of that is that she murders him, and then his son Orestes murders his own mother for murdering his father. And we'll get to that story later. But Zeus is thinking of this particular homecoming, and he remembers him as he spoke now before the immortals. Line 32. Oh, for shame! How the mortals put the blame upon us gods! For they say evils come from us, but it is they, rather, who by their own recklessness win sorrow beyond what is given. As now, lately, beyond what was given, Aegisthus married the wife of Atreus' son and murdered him on his homecoming. These phrases, what is given and beyond what was given, in 34 and 35, this means Aegisthus took what was beyond what was given to him, his own lot in life, his own destiny. He tried to increase it by marrying his cousin Agamemnon's wife Clytemnestra while Agamemnon was gone at Troy and Clytemnestra was hating him. Aegisthus tried to take beyond what was given. Line 37. Though he knew it was sheer destruction, for we ourselves had told him, sending Hermes, the mighty watcher, Argifontes, not to kill the man, nor court his lady for marriage. For vengeance would come on him from Orestes, son of Atreus, whenever he came of age and longed for his own country. And so here Zeus says he even sent Hermes and to tell Aegisthus not to kill Agamemnon, not to court Clytemnestra for marriage, because if he did, vengeance would come on him from Orestes, Agamemnon's son, when he got old enough. And of course he did. Line 42. So Hermes told him, but for all his kind intention, he could not persuade the mind of Aegisthus, and now he is paid for everything. Then in turn, the goddess, gray-eyed Athena, answered him. So this is Athena speaking to her father Zeus, line 45. Son of Cronus, our father, O lordliest of the mighty, Aegisthus indeed has been struck down in a death well merited. Let any other man who does thus perish as he did. But the heart of me is torn for the sake of wise Odysseus, unhappy man, who still, far from his friends, is suffering griefs on the sea-washed island, the navel of all the waters, a wooded island, and there a goddess has made her dwelling place. She is the daughter of the malignant Atlas, who has discovered all the depths of the sea, and himself sustains the towering columns which bracket earth and sky and hold them together. You know that Atlas holds up the sky. Line 55. This is his daughter. She detains the grieving, unhappy man, and ever with soft and flattering words, she works to charm him to forget Ithaca. And yet Odysseus, straining to get sight of the very smoke uprising from his own country, longs to die. But you, Olympian, the heart in you is heedless of him. Did not Odysseus do you grace by the ships of the Argives, making sacrifice in wide Troy? Why, Zeus, why are you now so harsh with him? And then in turn, Zeus, who gathers the clouds, made answer. And so he's talking to his daughter Athena. My child, what sort of word escaped your teeth's barrier? How could I forget Odysseus the godlike, he who is beyond all other men in mind, and who beyond others has given sacrifice to the gods, who hold wide heaven? It is the earth encircler, Poseidon, who ever relentless nurses a grudge because of the Cyclops, whose eye he blinded, for Polyphemus, like a god, whose power is greatest over all the Cyclops. This reference, lines 68 to 71, Of course, we are jumping into the book. Odysseus has been there about 7 years by the time it occurs to Athena to intervene with Zeus. For Odysseus, apparently 7 years to a goddess is nothing. 7 years to a mortal, of course, is a long time. And she's chosen now to intervene. And Zeus says, it's not my fault. It is Poseidon's fault. And it's because Odysseus blinded his son, the Cyclops Polyphemus. And of course, this we will not read until we get to the episode with the Cyclops, at which we hear in flashback. This makes the chronology of the Odyssey a little tricky to follow. Most of the action will take place in flashback, and it has to be this way for the plot to work. Line 71. Thaousa, a nymph, was his mother, and she was the daughter of Phorkys, who's the father of all the Cyclops, lord of the barren salt water. She, in the hollow of the caves, had lain with Poseidon. For his sake, Poseidon, shaker of the earth, although he does not kill Odysseus, line 75, yet drives him back from the land of his fathers. But come, let all of us who are here work out his homecoming and see to it that he returns. Poseidon shall put away his anger, for all alone and against the will of the other immortal gods united, he can accomplish nothing. Poseidon can't do anything more to Odysseus if we all join together against him. Line 80. Then in turn, the goddess, gray-eyed Athena, answered him, Son of Cronus, our father, O lordliest of the mighty, if in truth this is pleasing to the blessed immortals that Odysseus, of the many designs, shall return home, then let us dispatch Hermes, the guide, the slayer of Argus, to the land of Agagia, so that with all speed he may announce to the lovely-haired nymph, Calypso, our absolute purpose, the homecoming of enduring Odysseus, that he shall come back. But I shall make my way to Ithaca, this is the island Odysseus is king of, so that I may stir up his son a little, and put some confidence in him to summon into assembly the flowing-haired Achaeans, and make a statement to all the suitors, all 108 of them, who now forever slaughter his crowding sheep and lumbering horn-curved cattle. And I will convey him into Sparta, into sandy Pylos. Now, the flowing-haired Achaeans, she's going to put confidence in Telemachus, line 89, to summon into assembly the flowing-haired Achaeans, the Greeks, and make a statement to all the suitors who are slaughtering his crowding sheep and his lumbering horn-curved cattle. So what is Athena going to do? Athena is going to go down and give Telemachus, the son of Odysseus, who is now going on 20, give him some confidence, tell him to call an assembly of the Greeks, and to make a statement to all the suitors, and of course their parents might be in that assembly, that he's tired of them eating up his sheep and his cattle. They've been in his home for 4 years. And then where will she take him? Line 93. I will convey him into Sparta and to sandy Pylos. Who's the king of Sparta? Menelaus, and Helen will be there, and sandy Pylos, who's the king of Pylos? That is Nestor, of course. To ask after his dear father's homecoming if he can hear something, and so that among the people he may win a good reputation, Kleos, so that he can get good Kleos. So Athena's going to take Telemachus to go to Sparta to see Menelaus and Helen, and to Pylos to see Nestor, and ask after his dear father's homecoming. Have you heard what happened to Dad? You guys have been, he got home 10 years ago. Have you heard what happened to my father Odysseus? Line 96. Speaking so, she bound upon her foot the fair sandals, golden and immortal, that carried her over the water, as over the dry, boundless earth, abreast of the wind's blast. Then she caught up a powerful spear, edged with sharp bronze, line 100, heavy, huge, thick, wherewith she beats down the battalions of fighting men, against whom she of the mighty father is angered, and descended in a flash of speed from the peaks of Olympus, and lighted in the land of Ithaca, at the doors of Odysseus, at the threshold of the court, and in her hand was the bronze spear. So she lights on the island of Ithaca, where Odysseus was king, where Penelope, Odysseus's wife, waits, and her son Telemachus. They have been beswarmed by 108 suitors for the last 4 years who are eating them out of house and home. Line 105. She was disguised, this is Athena, as a friend, a leader of the Typhians, Mentes, or Mentor in some translations. And of course, this name that Athena takes on, Mentor, which means she will help Telemachus, This is the source of our word mentor. There she found the haughty suitors. These are the unholy suitors in line 106. These are the mensteras, agenaras, unholy suitors. They, at the moment, in front of the doors, were amusing their spirits with draughts, games, sitting about on skins of cattle whom they had slaughtered themselves, and about them, of their heralds and hard-working henchmen. Some at their mixing bowls were combining wine and water, while others again with porous sponges were wiping the tables and setting them out, and others cutting meat in quantities. Now, far the first to see Athena was godlike Telemachus, and remember she is in a disguise. Let's see, godlike Telemachus, as he sat among the suitors, his heart deep grieving within him, imagining in his mind his great father, how he might come back and all throughout the house might cause the suitors to scatter and hold his rightful place and be lord of his own possessions. So Telemachus is sitting there watching the suitors eat him out of house and home, daydreaming about how his father might come back and take his rightful place again. With such thoughts, sitting among the suitors, he saw Athena, okay? Athena mentor, so a man, and went straight to the forecourt, the heart within him scandalized that a guest, okay, as Aeneas, should still be standing at the doors. Telemachus jumps up to practice a proper Xenia. When a stranger comes to your home, and of course he will do this because this is pleasing to the gods. He stood beside her, line 120, and took her by the right hand and relieved her of the bronze spear, and spoke to her and addressed her in winged words. And of course words are always winged because words are kind of like birds or arrows going out. Welcome, stranger. You shall be entertained as a guest among us. Afterward, when you have tasted dinner, you shall tell us what your need is. Line 125. So speaking, he led the way, and Pallas Athena followed him. Now, when the two of them were inside the lofty dwelling, he took the spear he carried and set it against a tall column in a rack for spears of polished wood, where indeed there were other spears of patient-hearted Odysseus standing in numbers, and he led her and seated her in a chair with a cloth to sit on, the chair splendid and elaborate. This mention of the rack of spears in line 128 is a hint of something. Now we know that inside this hall is a rack of spears. They have belonged to Odysseus. They're still there 20 years from now. Keep this in the back of your mind. These will be needed up in book 22. The chair was splendid and elaborate, line 131. For her feet, there was a footstool. For himself, he drew a painted bench next to her. Apart from the others, the suitors, for fear the guest, made uneasy by the uproar, might lose his appetite there among overbearing people. So the suitors are a little bit of partiers. And so he might also ask him about his absent father. What is Telemachus's first thought? To ask this stranger, mentor, Athena, to ask if this person has heard anything about his father. Line 136. A maidservant brought water for them and poured it from a splendid and golden pitcher, holding it above a silver basin for them to wash, and she pulled a polished table before them. A grave housekeeper brought in the bread and served it to them, adding many good things to it, generous with her provisions, while a carver lifted platters of all kinds of meat and set them in front of them, and placed beside them in the golden goblets, and the herald, going back and forth, poured the wine for them. Then the haughty suitors, and these again are the menesteros, Agenoras, the unholy suitors. Then the haughty suitors came in, and all of them straightway, line 145, took their places in orders on chairs and along the benches, and their heralds poured water over their hands for them to wash with, and the serving maids brought them bread heaped up in the baskets, and the young men filled the mixing bowls with wine for their drinking. They put their hands to the good things that lay ready before them. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, the suitors found their attention turned to other matters, the song and the dance, for these things come at the end of the feasting. A herald put the beautifully wrought lyre in the hands of Phemius, this is the bard, who sang for the suitors because they made him. Line 155. He played his lyre and struck up a fine song, Meanwhile, Telemachus talked to Athena of the gray eyes, leaning his head close to hers, so that none of the others might hear him. Dear stranger, this is Telemachus to mentor mentees Athena. Dear stranger, would you be scandalized at what I say to you? This is all they think of, the lyre and the singing. Easy for them, since without penalty they eat up the substance of a man whose white bones lie out in the rain and fester somewhere on the mainland, or roll in the wash of the breakers. And so Telemachus is despairing. His father's bones are probably out on the mainland of Greece somewhere, or another mainland, or buried in the sea. If they were ever to see him coming back to Ithaca, all the prayer of them would all be to be lighter on their feet, okay, to be fast runners, instead of to be richer men for gold and clothing. As it is, he's died by an evil fate, and there is no comfort left for us, not even though someone among mortals tells us he will come back. His day of homecoming has perished. But come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer. Line 170. What man are you, and whence? Remember, in the discussion of Xenia, we discussed that it is first very important in the proper practice of Xenia to provide for all of your guests' needs. You will provide food, bath, whatever your guest has need of. Then you will ask who they are and ask any questions. Line 170. What man are you, and whence? Where is your city? Your parents? What kind of ship did you come here on? And how did the sailors bring you to Ithaca? What men do they claim that they are? For I do not think you could have traveled on foot to this country, because it's an island. And tell me this too, tell me truly, so that I may know it. Are you here for the first time? Or are you a friend of my father's from abroad? Since many other men too used to come and visit our house in the days when he used to go out among the people. Then in turn, the goddess gray-eyed Athena Mentes answered him, See, I will accurately answer all that you ask me. I announce myself as Mentes, my name is Mentor, son of Anchialus the wise, and my lordship is over the o'er-loving Typhians. And now I've come in, as you see, with my ship and companions, sailing over the wine-blue water to men of alien language, to Temese after bronze, and my cargo is gleaming iron, and my ship stands nearby at the country, away from the city, at the harbor, Raithrun. In other words, my ship is so far away, sorry, Telemachus, you can't see it. Underneath wooded Neon, your father and I claim to be guest friends, Xenoi. Now they're guest friends, by heredity, from far back, as you would know if you went to the aged hero Laertes, this is Odysseus's father, who they say no longer comes to the city now, Telemachus's grandfather, but away by himself on his own land leads a hard life with an old woman to look after him, who serves him his victuals and drink at the times when the weariness has befallen his body from making his toilsome way on the high ground of his vineyard. Now I have come. They told me he was here in this country, your father, I mean. But no, line 195, the gods are impeding his passage, for no death on the land has befallen the great Odysseus, but somewhere, alive on the wide sea, he is held captive on a sea-washed island, and savage men have him in their keeping, rough men who somehow keep him back, though he is unwilling. Line 200, now, I will make you a prophecy in the way the immortals put it into my mind, and of course this is Athena, and as I think it will come out, though I am no prophet, nor do I know the ways of birds clearly, and that's how you tell the future, reading augury, reading bird signs. He will not long be absent from the beloved land of his fathers, even if the bonds that hold him are iron, but he will be thinking of a way to come back, line 205, since he is a man of many resources. But come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer. Are you, big as you are, the very child of Odysseus? Indeed, you are strangely like about the head, the fine eyes, as I remember. You look like him. We used to meet so often together before he went away to Troy, line 210, where others besides him and the greatest of the Argives went in their hollow vessels. Since that time I've not seen Odysseus, nor has he seen me. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to her in answer, See, I will accurately answer all that you ask me. Line 215. My mother says, indeed, I am his. I, for my part, do not know. Nobody really knows his own father. But how I wish I could have been, rather, son to some fortunate man, whom old age overtook among his possessions. But of mortal men, that man has proved the most ill-fated whose son they say I am, since you question me on this matter. This is important. Telemachus wishes he had been the son of a fortunate man who died old with all of his possessions still, because then Telemachus would inherit everything. There wouldn't be no suitors if Odysseus had lived to be old in Ithaca, and he would have left. Penelope would not have to remarry, and he would have left everything to Telemachus. All right. Line 221. Then in turn, the goddess gray-eyed Athena answered him, "The gods have not made yours a birth that will go nameless hereafter," this means without Kleos, without fame, "because if his father died old with all his possessions on Ithaca, then Telemachus would inherit the fame of his father. But as it is with a missing father, Telemachus is in a very awkward position. The gods have not made yours a birth that will go nameless hereafter, since Penelope bore such a son as you are. But come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer." Line 225. "What feast is this? What gathering? How does it concern you, a festival or a wedding? Surely no communal dinner." So Mentes Athena says, "Tell me, what kind of party is going on here? How insolently they seem to swagger about in their feasting all through the house. A serious man who came in among them could well be scandalized, seeing much disgraceful behavior." Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to her in answer, "My guest," okay, my Zinnia, "since indeed you are asking me all these questions, there was a time this house was one that might be prosperous and above reproach when a certain man was here in his country. But now the gods with evil intention have willed it otherwise, and they have caused him to disappear in a way no other man has done. I should not have sorrowed so over his dying if he had gone down among his companions in the land of the Trojans, or in the arms of his friends after he had wound up the fighting. So all the Achaeans would have heaped a grave mound over him, and he would have won great fame," okay, mega Kleos, "for himself and his son hereafter," that's Telemachus. "But how ingloriously, non-Kleos, if you will, the storm winds have caught and carried him away, out of sight, out of knowledge, and he left pain and lamentation to me. Nor is it for him alone that I grieve in my pain now, no longer, for the gods have inflicted other cares on me. For all the greatest men who have the power in the islands, in Dulichion and Saint Same, and in wooded Zacynthus, and all who in rocky Ithaca are holders of lordships, all these are after my mother for marriage, and wear my house out. And she does not refuse the hateful marriage, nor is she able to make an end of the matter, because her father isn't, her husband isn't there. And these, eating up my substance, wasted away, and soon they'll break me myself to pieces. Soon they will realize that I too might be a threat, since I'm almost 20, and may kill me also." Line 251. And of course, why cannot she refuse hateful marriage? Because if her husband is dead, she has to return to the home of her father, or she has to take another husband. And Odysseus is missing. 252. Pallas Athena, Mentor, answered him in great indignation, "Oh, for shame! How great your need is now of the absent Odysseus, who would lay his hands on these shameless suitors. I wish he could come now to stand in the outer doorway of his house, wearing a helmet and carrying shield and two spears, the way he was the first time I ever saw him in our own house, drinking his wine and taking his pleasure, coming in from Ephyre," this is another name for Corinth, "and from Ilus, son of Myrmerus." Line 260. Odysseus, you see, had gone there also in his swift ship in search of a poison to kill men. Remember, Odysseus is very clever. "So he might have it to smear on his bronze-headed arrows," poisoned arrows. "But Ilus would not give him any, since he feared the gods who endure forever. But my father did give it to him, so terribly did he love him. I wish that such an Odysseus would come now among the suitors. They all would find death was quick and marriage a painful matter. Yet all these are things that are lying upon the gods' knees, whether he will come home to his vengeance here in his household or whether he will not. Rather, I will urge you to consider some means by which you can force the suitors out of your household. Come now, pay close attention to me, and do as I tell you. Tomorrow, summon the Achaean warriors into assembly, and publish your word to all. Let the gods be your witnesses." And this is an interesting side note. The word witness in the Greek is, of course, martyroi. Martyroi. Martyr. Let the gods be your witnesses. That's the Greek word for witness. "Tell the suitors to scatter and go back to their own holdings. And as for your mother, If the spirit urges her to be married, let her go back to the palace of her powerful father, her powerful father, Megaron Patras, Mega Dunominoi. And of course, dunamis is where we get our word dynamite. It is a word that means powerful, her powerful father. And they shall appoint the marriage and arrange for the wedding presents in great amount, as ought to go with a beloved daughter. But for yourself, I will counsel you shrewdly and hope you will listen. Fit out a ship with 20 oars, the best you can come by, and go out and ask about your father who is so long absent. On the chance some mortal man can tell you who has listened to rumor sent by Zeus. She, more than others, spreads news among people. All right. First, go to Pylos, and there question the great Nestor. And from there, go over to Sparta, line 285, to see the fair-haired Menelaus, since he came home last of all the bronze-armored Achaeans. Thus, if you hear your father is alive and on his way home, then, hard-pressed though you are, you should still hold out for another year. But if you hear he has died and lives no longer, line 290, then make your way home to the beloved land of your fathers, and pile up a tomb in his honor, and there make sacrifices in great amount, as is fitting, and give your mother to a husband. Then, after you have made an end of these matters and done them, next you must consider well in your heart and spirit some means by which you can kill the suitors who are in your household by treachery or open attack. You should not go on clinging to your childhood. Line 296 and 297, Athena Asmentes is telling Telemachus, it's time to grow up. You are no longer of an age to do that. Or have you not heard what glory, what chaos, was won by great Orestes among all mankind when he killed the murderer of his father, the treacherous Aegisthus, who had slain his famous father? This is another important side note. She says, didn't you hear about what happened when Agamemnon came home? Clytemnestra had taken up with Agamemnon's cousin Aegisthus, and Orestes, they killed Agamemnon. Orestes, as soon as he finished growing up, then killed his mother. And Athena Mentes says, didn't you hear about that? Why is she telling him the story of a son avenging his father? Orestes avenging Agamemnon, because she's planting in the mind of Telemachus that it is his responsibility to avenge his own father also. Line 301. So you too, dear friend, since I can see you are big and splendid, be bold also, so that in generations to come they will praise you. Get his own chaos. But now it is time for me to go back down to my fast ship and my companions, who must be very restless waiting for me. Let all this be on your mind, and do as I tell you. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to her in answer, my guest, your words to me are very kind and considerate, what any father would say to his son. I shall not forget them. But come now, stay with me, eager though you are for your journey, so that you may first bathe and take your ease, and well rested and happy in your heart, then go back to your ship with a present, something prized, Time, altogether fine, which will be your keepsake from me, what loving guests and hosts bestow on one another. Then in turn the goddess gray-eyed Athena answered him. Line 315. Do not detain me longer, eager as I am for my journey. And that gift, whatever it is, your dear heart bids you give me, save it, to give when I come next time, so I can take it home and choose a good one, and a fair exchange will befall you. You give me a good gift, I'll give you a good gift. Save it for the next time I see you. Line 319. So spoke the goddess gray-eyed Athena, and there she departed, like a bird, soaring high in the air, but she left in his spirit determination and courage, and he remembered his father even more than he had before, and he guessed the meaning. He guesses she could be divinity down there to give him confidence and advice, since she looked like a bird and flew away. And he guessed the meaning, and his heart was full of wonder, for he thought it was a divinity. At once he went over, a godlike man, to sit with the suitors. Line 325. The famous singer, this is the same Phemius back from the same book, book 1, line 155. The famous singer was singing to them. Remember, they made him, and they in silence sat listening. He sang of the Achaeans' bitter homecoming from Troy, which Pallas Athena had inflicted upon them. Why do the Achaeans have a bitter homecoming? because inside the temple of Athena at Troy, when they destroyed the temple, Aias committed atrocities toward Cassandra. The daughter of Icarus, Icarius, circumspect Penelope, heard and heeded the magical song from her upper chamber. And so Penelope hears that, and we know that Penelope is the daughter of the Spartan Icarius, not Icarus, Icarius, who is the brother of Tyndarus. Remember, Tyndarus is the father of Helen and Clytemnestra, and he had the problem of how to get Helen a husband and made all the suitors make a promise. Odysseus told them, told Tyndarus he could solve his problem of what to do with Helen, and gave Tyndarus the idea of making all the suitors promise that if they were not chosen to marry Helen, that they would protect her forever and go after her if she was ever stolen again. And of course, Icarius, as the brother of Tyndarus, Penelope's father, Odysseus said to Tyndarus, "I'll tell you the solution, but I won't even ask for Helen, I won't try. I want your niece, your brother's daughter, Penelope." And those are the parents. That's the parent of Penelope. Diversion there. Line 328. The daughter of Icarius, circumspect Penelope, heard and heeded the magical song from her upper chamber and descended the high staircase that was built in her palace, not all alone, since two handmaidens went to attend her. She has 50, only two come with her. A woman will not go down amongst all those suitors alone. When she, shining among women, came near the suitors, she stood by the pillar that supported the roof with its joinery, holding her shining veil in front of her face to shield it. Line 335. And a devoted attendant was stationed on either side of her. All in tears, she spoke then to the divine singer. "Phemius, since you know many other actions of mortals and gods, which can charm men's hearts, and which the singers celebrate, sit beside them and sing one of these, and let them in silence go on drinking their wine, but leave off singing this sad song, which always afflicts the dear heart deep inside me, since the unforgettable sorrow comes to me beyond others, so dear a head do I long for, whenever I am reminded of my husband, whose fame goes wide through Hellas and midmost Argus." So Penelope tells Phemius the bard, "Sing about something else. Don't sing about the bitter homecoming, all of those who get killed or who don't come home." Line 345. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to her in answer, and remember, Athena went down and gave him confidence. So here's the new Telemachus. Why, my mother, do you begrudge this excellent singer his pleasing himself as the thought drives him? It is not the singers who are to blame. It must be Zeus is to blame, who gives out to men to eat bread to each and all the way he wills it. There's nothing wrong in his singing the sad return of the Danaans. People surely always give more applause to that song, which is the latest to circulate among the listeners. So he says he's only singing it because it's the newest song. So let your heart and let your spirit be hardened to listen. Odysseus is not the only one who lost his homecoming day at Troy. Line 355. There were many others who perished besides him. Go therefore back in the house and take up your own work, the loom and the distaff, and see to it that your maidens ply their work also. But the men must see to discussion, all men. But I most of all, for mine is the power in this household. Line 360. Penelope went back inside the house. This would be better translated as back inside her room. In amazement. Why is she amazed? Because Telemachus just gave her an order. He just acted like the man of the house. For she laid the serious words of her son deep away in her spirit, and she went back to the upper story with her attendant women, and wept for Odysseus, her beloved husband, until gray-eyed Athena cast sweet slumber over her eyelids. Line 365. But the suitors, all through the shadowy halls, were raising a tumult, and all prayed for the privilege of lying beside her, until the thoughtful Telemachus began speaking among them. "You suitors of my mother, overbearing in your rapacity, now let us dine and take our pleasure, and let there be no shouting, since it is a splendid thing to listen to a singer who is such a singer as this man is." Okay, they're being rude, talking and shouting well. Phemius is singing, and with a voice such as gods have. "Then tomorrow let us all go to the place of assembly and hold a session, where I'll give you my forthright statement that you go out of my palace and do your feasting elsewhere, eating up your own possessions, taking turns household by household. Okay, we're calling a meeting to assembly. This is exactly what Athena was going to go down and tell him to do. And I'm going to tell you tomorrow in assembly, which means in the presence of all of the elders, which would include their fathers, that instead of sitting here in my mother's house eating and drinking and eating us out of house and home, you'll go from one house to the other of the suitors. After all, there are more than 100 of them. Line 376. But if you decide it's more profitable and better to go on eating up one man's livelihood without payment, then spoil my house. I will cry out to the gods everlasting in the hope that Zeus might somehow grant a reversal of fortunes. Line 380. Then you may perish in this house with no payment given. This is almost prophecy. And of course, Homer's audience will know it. They know the whole story. They know the end. So he spoke, and all of them bit their lips in amazement at Telemachus and the daring way he had spoken to them. So the suitors are used to Telemachus being a wuss. His mother Penelope is shocked that he is so forthright, and the suitors are also shocked. And of course, they will not like it that Telemachus will stand up for himself. It was Antinous, the son of Epithes, who answered, Telemachus, surely it must be the very gods who prompt you to take the imperious line and speak so daringly to us. I hope the son of Cronos never makes you our king in sea-girt Ithaca, though to be sure that is your right by inheritance. This line, 386, I hope the son of Cronos never makes you our king in sea-girt Ithaca. Not only, of course, does he want to be king instead of Telemachus, the implication here is that you are a wuss. I hope Zeus never makes you our king in sea-girt Ithaca. Line 288. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said in answer, Antinous, in case you wonder at what I am saying, I would be willing to take that right to be king if Zeus should give it. Do you think that is the worst thing that could happen to anyone? It is not bad to be a king. Speedily the king's house grows prosperous, and he himself has rank beyond others. But in fact, there are many other Achaean princes, young and old, in sea-girt Ithaca, any of whom might hold this position, now that the great Odysseus has perished. But I will be the absolute lord over my own household and my servants, whom the great Odysseus won by force for me. Then in turn, Eurymachus, son of Polybus, answered, Line 400, Telemachus, these matters, and which of the Achaeans will be king in sea-girt Ithaca, are questions that lie on the gods' knees. But I hope you keep your possessions and stay, lord, in your own household. May the man never come who, against your will and by force, shall drive you away from all your holdings, while Ithaca is a place still lived in. Line 405. But, best of men, I wish to ask you about this stranger, where he came from, what country he announces as being his own, where lies his parent stock, and the fields of his fathers. Has he brought some message from your father, who is on his way here? Or did he arrive pursuing some matter of his own business? How suddenly he started away. And, of course, Eurymachus is talking here about Mentes, Athena. How suddenly he started away and vanished, and did not wait to be made known. Line 411. He was no mean man by the look of him. Now they have judged Mentes, Athena, by the appearance of him. And mean here is in the sense of common. He didn't look like a common man. He's no mean man by the look of him. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to him in answer, Eurymachus, there is no more hope of my father's homecoming. And now we see that Telemachus has his father's ability to be very evasive when he needs to. This is Homer's way of showing us that now that Telemachus has been, now that he has more confidence from Athena, he's becoming more like Odysseus, because, of course, Homer's audience, for them to accept Telemachus as a helper for Odysseus or the son of Odysseus, for Telemachus to be worthy to be the son of Odysseus, he's got to prove himself. And he proves that he is just as tricky. He can be evasive. He's telling them what he believes is the best thing for them to hear right now. Eurymachus, there's no more hope of my father's homecoming. I believe no messages anymore, even should there be one. Line 415. Nor pay attention to any prophecy. Those times my mother calls some diviner into the house and asks him questions. This stranger is a friend of my father's. He comes from Taphus and announces himself as Mentes, the son of Anchialus, the wise, and he is lord of the lovers of the oar, the Typhians. Line 420. So spoke Telemachus, but in his heart he knew the immortal goddess. The others, turning to the dance and the delightful song, took their pleasure and awaited the coming of evening. And the black evening came on as they were taking their pleasure. Then they went home to go to bed, each to his own house. But Telemachus went where, off the splendid courtyard, a lofty bedchamber had been built for him, in a sheltered corner. There he went to go to bed, his heart full of problems, and devoted Eurycleia went with him, and carried the flaring torches. This is his servant. She was the daughter of Ops, the son of Pisenor, and Laertes, Odysseus's father, Telemachus's grandfather, had bought her long ago with his own possessions, when she was still in her first youth, and gave 20 oxen for her. This is a huge sum for a slave. And he favored her in his house as much as his own devoted wife, but never slept with her for fear of his wife's anger. She now carried the flaring torches for him. She loved him more than the other maidservants, and had nursed him when he was little. He opened the doors of the close, compacted bedchamber, and sat down on the bed, and took off his soft tunic, and put it into the hands of the sagacious old woman. And she in turn folded the tunic and took care of it for him, and hung it up on a peg beside the corded bedstead. Then she went out of the room and pulled the door to behind her with a silver hook, and a strap drew home the door bolt. There, all night long, wrapped in a soft sheepskin, he pondered in his heart the journey that Pallas Athena had counseled. So now he's considering as he goes to sleep what kind of journey Pallas Athena had counseled. This note about pulling the door to behind her, line 4, 4, 1 through 2, this does not mean that Telemachus is locked inside his room. He can open it by pulling a string on a hole. This is just the way the door is locked. Now, we've ended book one by starting the story in Ithaca. The listener understands straight away how desperate the home situation is here in Ithaca. We cannot follow events chronologically, which would be easier for readers. First of all, we need to know, why is it important for Odysseus to return home? Why is there a big hurry about all this? The listener now knows from Homer's book one that Ithaca is in peril. Penelope is on the verge of being forced to marry someone. Telemachus has been on the verge of being forced out of his home or killed, perhaps murdered. It's extremely important now that Odysseus returns home. This kind of heightens the anticipation for book two and the rest of the story to see, oh my goodness, they're desperate for him on Ithaca. Will he get home? And of course, this is also just epic pattern. We began in medias res. We began in the middle of the story, and this means all of Odysseus's wanderings between Troy and Ithaca are going to be told to us in flashback. Odysseus will go somewhere, and they'll say, "Tell us about Troy," and he will tell them. All right. Thank you.